podcasts from the road, 17th and 18th of February 2012. For more info, please visit our website uberlife.com.au.
What I want to sort of talk about tonight, as we, or this afternoon as we end, is essentially what we've been talking about this whole weekend, is that we live in a time where the reins of power have been handed over. That you exist in a time where the ways that have made the world have sense for the last 500-600 years have eroded, have been passed over to a new way of understanding, that you're at the forefront, as I said in the first talk, you're at the frontier of a new way of understanding yourself. The most dramatic pictorial image I saw of this was this one. And this image is so ludicrous. Now, has anyone here seen the movie The King's Speech? In that movie, Colin Firth's character, the king, who, you know, it was embarrassment that he had this speech defect. They talk in the movie about his younger brother who had epilepsy, who was basically hidden from the public. The royal family was this untouchable thing because it represented this rule that had gone back for centuries, 1,000 years. And the king, and you've seen that movie, they talk about it, was the king of the head of the Church of England, the queen is today. Now, I want you to think about all of that when you look at this picture and what it means. It's a stunning picture. When I saw this picture, I thought, this is the handing over of the reins of power. This is actually, when you get beyond it, almost the transference of one worldview into another. And the bleeding through of these worldviews are what we are living through. The fact that the Queen would meet someone like this tells you very much about the world that we live in today. 20 years ago, 50 years ago, it just would not have happened. That the Queen would wave at commoners from the window. But to meet someone like Lady Gaga and everything she stands for, which is sort of this completely distorted view of the world thrown back to us, means that we're living in a time where people understand that, in a sense, the system's broken. What I realized about Lady Gaga is that Lady Gaga, I couldn't work out at the beginning. I think I mentioned on the first night that I wrote an essay for a magazine, and me and another guy researched her, and I didn't know much about her. I didn't like her music. Still don't like her music. And what I realized, I couldn't understand. Here's this sort of grotesque figure. There's sort of this thing where they talk about the sexualization of culture. But she's throwing back this broken, strange, grotesque form. And I realized what she's doing. She's putting a mirror up to a culture that's grown up in a secular world, which has grown up in a world where families are breaking down, a world where sexual abuse is normal, where dysfunction and addiction is normal, and she's saying, this is what you are. The resonance that her fans have with this is incredibly powerful. She's the most powerful person on Twitter, one of the most powerful people on this planet. And what she's showing to us is, I think, part of the crack that the gospel enters into in this world. That when we look at our culture, and it's often I feel disheartened when I'm driving through Melbourne, anywhere in Australia, New Zealand, just beautiful places. Credit Suisse recently just came out with the statement that Australians are the richest people in the world. Melbourne and Sydney are now 50% more expensive to live in than New York. The Australian dollar is pumping. There's this term they talk about now called economic hypochondria, which is this crazy thing that we're living through this boom time, and because we see on the news, oh, Greece and this, oh, we mustn't have much money. But actually, we're living in this insane time of wealth. Where does the gospel enter into a culture when everyone has everything that they want? I actually think that when we look for the rumours of God, I was talking to Andrew just in the break, it's almost we're saying the mission we feel now is looking into the culture and looking for those stories where the gospel bubbles up. One of them, I think, is in people's personal pain. Here we have Kerouac, again, embodying everything that's cool, the distant look, the aloof male, the cigarette, the jacket. James Dean was obsessed with him. Marlon Brando was obsessed with him. All of the archetypes of cool come out of his persona. But 10 years later, I talked about him and how he was different. After his experience with the cross, it's not some good news story where he then goes and does the speaking circuit in churches. For him, he has this return to God. He returns to Laos, where he left. He marries the sister of his best friend who was killed on the beach at Anzio in World War II. And finally returns, having sort of traveled everywhere back home. But the consequences of his life up to this point are just incredible. Here's a picture taken on his last sort of visit to his friends. In this picture, it's stunning. Gone is the cool guy. And what we see is the lid is lifted behind the Levi's dream. And we see the price. A confused, almost looks like a homeless man. And I think when we begin to look, as Andrew said today, at the story, our cultural myths, these people that Justine Cho in Sydney at the Centre for Public Christian Centres and Christian Communication and Public Centres and Seminars says that people today want immortality. We actually don't want a heaven or we don't want a hell. We actually don't want to ever die. That our views now are actually not that God comes and transforms the world. We also don't want the view that basically we just die and that's it. So we almost now desire to never age. And history remembers Kerouac as that guy driving across America. Pretty girls in the back of the car. His friend, Neil Cassidy, next to him. Jazz playing on the radio under an impossibly starry Midwestern sky. But we don't remember what is the price when we focus upon idols. And that exile that has been spoken about this weekend is actually a personal exile. That it's actually a spiritual exile, and it has consequences. It's not just something written in the Bible that's not true, but it actually counts and matters in real time in this world. In my book, The Vertical Self, I talked about the life of Marilyn Monroe. Again, one of these classic figures. If Kerouac defines cool, Marilyn Monroe defines the archetype of probably what we know as sexy, or she's the classic sex goddess. She creates that personality. A girl who's moved from foster home to foster home, who looks out of her house windows and sees the studios in Burbank where she lived, looking for real parents. And she sees, and she sits in the movie screen, I want to be like one of those women. She dyes her hair. This is Arthur Miller, who was her one true love. Arthur Miller was a playwright, wrote The Crucible. And she felt at home with him because he accepted her not just as a beautiful woman, but actually who she was, a smart, intelligent, sensitive artist who put on this persona to the world. Marilyn Monroe totally bought into the story of the selves that I told on the first night. She gave over her entire life to her psychotherapist. Her psychotherapist came up with this theory that what she needed, because she hadn't had this parental figure and she had this life where she moved around, that what he did is he set her up just around the corner from his family. She literally came into his family like a child. And she would come to dinner. He set up her apartment in which she died exactly like his home, in the same colours and the same pictures on the wall. And the whole idea here was that what she really needed to do was just connect with a sense of who she really was, to just connect with that inner child to be happy. The story doesn't end in happiness. Redemption doesn't come from just being yourself, finding yourself. Marilyn Monroe, the most beautiful woman in the world, still today just recently won the sexiest woman of all time because she lives in immortality in our minds. Dies, and the images of her died, found by a housekeeper with a telephone in her hand. She takes an overdose of pills and tries to call someone, but the woman who is wanted, desired by the world, admired, dies completely lonely with no one to call. Arthur Miller, reflecting on this, said something I think incredibly powerful. I'm pretty sure the guy's not a Christian. But he said this, reflecting on her life and her attempts to heal herself. He said, "The greatest truths we know have come out of people's suffering. That the problem is not to undo suffering or to wipe it off the face of the earth, but to make it inform our lives. Instead of trying to cure ourselves of it constantly and avoid it, and avoid anything but that lobotomized sense of what they call happiness." The prophet Ezekiel lived at a time where Israel had found this destruction that comes from the worship of idols. The root of this idolatry is a forgetfulness of God. And by the banks of the Kabar River, he has this incredible vision encounter with God that only comes when he understands really what exile means. And if you look at particularly Isaiah 6, if you want to turn to that now, I don't normally look at the Bible on my iPhone. I did leave it in the back row. Loading. I've got one. It just loaded. God says in verse 3, and this sounds harsh. I'll just read the whole thing. Let's go from 1. Again, a message came to me from the Lord. Son of man, turn and face the mountains of Israel and prophesy against them. Proclaim this message from the sovereign Lord against the mountains of Israel. This is what the sovereign Lord says to the mountains and hills, to the ravines and valleys. Now, to understand this, he's not just like pointing at a particular mountain, pointing at the Dandenong Mountains and going, I hate you. The mountains and the high places were where the pagan worship occurred. This is where people, when their trust of God evaporated, and they returned to this sense of paganism. And God says this, I'm about to bring war upon you. I will smash your pagan shrines. All your altars will be demolished. Your places of worship will be destroyed. I will kill your people in front of your idols. I will lay your corpses in front of your idols and scatter your bones about your idols. Wherever you live, there will be desolation, and I will destroy your pagan shrines. Your altars will be demolished. Your idols will be smashed. Your places of worship will be torn down, and all the religious objects you have made will be destroyed. The place will be littered with corpses, and you will know that I am alone the Lord. I remember reading and thinking about this when that footage came out of the UK riots. When the UK riots happened, there was this massive debate. Basically, the left wing pointed and said, this is because the Thatcher governments onwards, the Blair governments have not put money into education, they've not built community. The right wings pointed and said, this is because we've lost a sense of morality, kids, you know, don't serve in the army anymore, there's no sense of discipline. There was one moment which shocked the world in the UK riots, and it was the footage of a young Malaysian man who had come to the United Kingdom to study, a visitor from a foreign land. In the biblical imagination, visitors, refugees, aliens in our midst, people of God were asked to welcome them in, bring them, show them hospitality. In the Middle East, the idea of hospitality is just paramount. You offer up your food. You offer a place in your home. You feed these people before you even ask why they're there. And here we have Britain, a culture that's been Christian for over 1,000 years, which has had revivals and churches, half the movements that probably in this room that we're part of come out of this country. Here's this culture built upon Christianity. And here's this scene of this young man walking in the middle of the day. This part didn't happen at night. And this man whacks him. His teeth are knocked out. He's on the curb with his hand over his mouth, teeth falling out, blood streaming out of his mouth. That wasn't the worst part. That's the Good Samaritan moment. Then this vision comes, and this guy bends down, puts his arm around him, and you can see him asking, are you all right, mate? And instantly when I saw that, in my biblical memory, it invoked images of the Good Samaritan. The kingdom moment is about to come in this story. Oh, this is fantastic. YouTube, in the midst of, you know, horror, one guy who's young in England who's standing up for good. But then you see the guy reaching into his backpack, stealing his phone, robbing him. And then he walks up with his mate and gives him a high five and laughs. And when I saw that, I actually thought, what this is exile. This is the end game of secularism. That what you witnessed there, yes, it is a failure of education. It's a failure of community. It's a failure of decency. It's a failure of everything. But ultimately, it's a failure of belief. Give a whole generation of kids nothing to believe in. Fill them with pornography. Put them in front of single shooter video games. Fill them with violent rap music. Tell them that life is a commodity, that they're cosmic accidents, that they do not matter. And you'll get this. And the problem with Australia is that it's shiny and nice on the surface. But increasingly, we're becoming spiritually empty. Australia is marked by a forgetfulness. We don't even think about the people who lived in our houses 20 years ago. We don't think about the migrants who worked hard to build this culture coming from all over the world 50 years ago. We don't think about the first settlers coming 150 years ago. We don't think about what happened with the convicts. And William Wilberforce and the Clapham sect had a meeting about whether Australians are slaves, that the convicts were basically slaves. And some of the people in that group said, well, we need to free these. We're freeing the African slave trade. We need to free Australians. We don't like to think of ourselves like that. And we don't think about our Indigenous history. We live in a forgetfulness that is essentially pagan. That what we've been looking at this weekend is to fight this is a sense of remembrance. Verse 8. But I will let a few people escape destruction, and they will be scattered amongst the nations of the world. Now think about that. The people sent into mission to proclaim the good news are those who have known exile, known destruction, known death. Then, when they are exiled among the nations, they will remember me. They recognize how hurt I am by their unfaithful hearts and lustful eyes that long for idols. Then at last they will hate themselves for all their detestable sins. Okay, think about that journey I took you on understanding the self. Now read that. Let's read again. Then finally they will understand that their inner child needs to be loved. And through a process of loving themselves, looking in the mirror, filling their lives with self-esteem messages, everything will be fantastic. No. Then they will hate themselves for all of their detestable sins. Verse 10. Then they will know that I alone am God, and that I was serious when I said that I would bring calamity upon them. When you look at this movement of concepts, it begins with this remembrance that the people who've forgotten have fallen into idolatry, that idolatry brings destruction, that destruction brings death, both spiritual and eternal. That's the same thing. Both physically and eternal. But the way back is a remembrance. Remembrance leads to a knowledge of God, which leads to worship. And I'm not just talking here about just musical worship. I'm talking about an entire way of looking at life, the living of your life. As Romans says, it's a living sacrifice. And this is the key I want to bring out tonight. That leads to sacredness. And when I saw that man in England rob that Malaysian man, I thought secular culture is not just the culture which is bereft of God, but bereft of any idea of the sacred. When you remove God from the public sphere, nothing becomes sacred. We believe in a story and we envelop ourselves in a story which says God created the world. He created every creature. Everything that you see is designed, that you were designed, that God knit you in your mother's womb, that He controls the world, that He animates everything. And when you believe that, you begin to develop a very different way of looking at the world, a way of looking at the world where you see it in the book of Revelation, you see it in Ezekiel's encounter with God, where you realize that there's this other realm, that heaven's not just a place we nick to when we die, but that heaven is a place where God's will happens in fullness. And the book of Revelation, there's this sort of parallel that in the Old Testament, it talks about the prophets and the people of God having to be forced to hide in caves. When we look at the book of Revelation, it's the kings and the powerful people of the world, the tyrants, who are hiding in the caves. And that actually the world, as Donald Crable said, is an upside-down kingdom. And that the way we need to look at the world and remember is that actually the world, a place like Melbourne, isn't a shiny, designed, beautiful city, that underneath it, there can be a rotten core. Yes, there are elements which need to be fulfilled and flourished, but only when we take a completely different view of the world and look at it through God's eyes will we see what really matters. And the overall sweeping indictment of young adult Christians in Australia today is that we are looking for things with the wrong value. That it's almost like you've broken into a department store and someone's switched all of the price tags. That milk of $5,000, a Lamborghini, 20 cents. To sort of bring things home, I want to tell a story about a man who I just heard briefly about his life. And for my book, I end up researching him. He's become a hero of mine. He's a man who came to God from a background of being a scientist. He was a committed atheist. A couple of things happened to him. One moment was when his mother died, and he looked at her face, this committed atheist, incredibly intelligent man, this scientist who saw everything through atoms and materialism. And as he watched his mother's face die, something inside of his head said, there's something more. Something just left her body. His hero was a guy called Blaise Pascal, who wrote a book called Pensées, which is a reflection. He thought that this was a book on science. Pascal was a scientist, but he's also a Christian. And Takashi Nagai, one of the leading scientists in the 1930s in Japan, picked up this book by what he thought was a fellow scientist, but didn't realize he was a believer as well. And in the midst of Japan, which is one of the most unchurched cultures in the world, becomes a Christian. He decides, because of his passion for science and his passion for God, that what he needs to study is a science that actually helps people. He begins to study the emerging field of radiography, of X-rays, in the hope that the sort of power of the atom can actually heal people. The problem is you don't want to be a pioneer in that field in the early days. So if you go now for an X-ray or you go for a CAT scan or whatever, that you'll notice that the people leave the room. They go behind a leaden wall to protect them from the effects of radiation. Takashi Nagai, in this opening field of study, begins to notice that he's ill. He begins to suspect, being a scientist, being a doctor, that he's got cancer. He goes to his friend who confirms it and tells him, you've got approximately 4 years to live. Takashi Nagai had married his wife, Midori. Midori lived in a place called Nagasaki, a city, in a particular suburb called Urakami. Urakami is famous because it's the place where Japan's hidden Christians live. The hidden Christians were a group of people who were descended from the first Christians when the Franciscan monks went to Japan in the 16th century. And they became Christians. Eventually, a shogun who was in charge resented this foreign influence. And he declared and let loose probably one of the worst persecution Christians have seen anywhere in the world since the early church. Christians were killed in multiple ways. This is a picture of a killing of a whole bunch of different Christians at that time. You'll see in the picture if you look closely. There's Christians who are crucified. Christians were burnt alive. The shogun's troops went to incredible levels. What they would do is that they would put a picture of Jesus on the ground and they would lead the occupants of Urakami out. And those who stepped on it would be sent to the left and they would live. And those who refused to step on it would go to the right. And they just would not be killed. One of the worst ways, there's several hundred people killed outside of Urakami, where they would dig these holes, fill it with excrement, and hang you upside down. You took about 4 or 5 days to die. The people who died by crucifixion were happy that they didn't get killed like this. One of the men at this time who was put on a cross gave on the cross as he was dying an incredible sermon. You can look it up today. And people heard that. And as a result, some of the people who had gone left began to feel convicted. They couldn't turn their back on Christ. And they began to worship in secret. Takashi Nagai had married into this family of this woman who'd known 300 years of persecution, of hiding your faith. Eventually, in the 19th century, some Americans, including the Civil War general Ulysses S. Grant, pressured the Japanese government to just at least allow these Christians to worship in freedom. They raised some money. I think the Portuguese gave some money. I think even the Brazilians gave some money. And they built a cathedral called Urakami Cathedral. And they built it literally on the spot where the people had been forced to walk over the picture. So here's Takashi Nagai walking the streets from his university hospital to tell the most terrible thing that you can tell your wife and your two young children. I've got 4 years to live. As he walked through the lush paths and gardens of Nagasaki, he asked the question, God, what are you doing? Why have you allowed this? You've brought me to you. You've gifted me in this way that I can help millions of people with this research. You've given me two beautiful children. We're Japanese Christians. We need to spread your word here. Why am I dying? He enters into his house, sits down for a very traditional lunch with Midori, and tells her. He says in his recollections that Midori didn't say a word, but she shook. She then said to him, let's pray. And they turned and faced the wall against which they'd pray, upon which there was a cross. A few months after this, Takashi Nagai is at his office, continuing his work. He tried to work as long as he could. And every day in his mind, he would think of that moment when his wife would be there and his children, and he'd finally say goodbye. Outside, the world changed. Everything went red. A blinding flash of light, so powerful, moved through the building, through his body. He found himself thrown underneath a table, trapped, utter confusion. A woman who was in a building not so far away literally thought she was transported to hell. She was a kindergarten teacher. She looked this way at the kids playing in the kindergarten, her kindergarten students. She looked this way, looked back, and saw her entire class with no skin. The mountains red, the skies red, and she thought, God, you've taken me to hell. The atomic bomb had been dropped on Nagasaki. What had happened was that the bomb was actually meant to be dropped on a different city. The bomber was heading towards another city, and at the last moment, the weather changed. His secondary target was Nagasaki. And the irony was that the sights for the bombardier to line up and drop the bomb was the cross of Urakami Cathedral. The atomic bomb dropped on Nagasaki was detonated approximately 500 meters above the site where the Christians of Urakami had been forced to walk over the face of Jesus 300 years ago. The community in Japan, which had been the most ostracized, that even during the war were put into camps, seen as allying with the troops because with the Allies because you know they were Christians, they weren't Japanese, they were seen because they worshipped this other god. The people who'd gone through 300 years of persecution now have an atomic bomb dropped on them. Takashi Nagai, under his desk, is eventually freed. And it's almost at this moment that sense comes of the situation. A man who's been given 4 years to live. When he walked home that time to see his wife, could never have dreamt that he would be living in a city where everyone else would have a death sentence. That his body at that time, before the atomic bomb was dropped, filled with radiation, that all of his neighbours would join him in this death sentence. His first thought is for Midori, to go home to see her. How is she? But he knows that as a professor at the university, as a Christian, that he actually has to serve the people around him. For 3 days until the military come, he serves and binds people up and just practices basic first aid, praying the whole time. People start to look to this man with cancer who's dying as some kind of leader. God brings about strange leaders in strange times. If you're a bit strange here tonight, good. You're going to be needed. And what happens is, eventually the army come and he's able to go and he walks through the streets. Here's a picture of the district of Urakami, the sports ground you can see there. Top picture is before, bottom picture is after. Literally decimated. Here's a picture of his neighbourhood. You can see the remains of the church in the background, just obliterated. He can't even find his street. He can barely find his house. He has to work it out. And finally, he sees these walls. He moves to the back of the house and sees a pile of dust. In the pile, he sees the bones of a hand holding a cross. It's Midori. He shovels his wife's remains into a bucket and takes her to the burial plot. He always thought, he said in his biography, that he'd be laying there and she'd be holding his hand as he died. He never, ever thought that he'd be picking his wife's remains of dust in a bucket and carrying it down to the graveyard the way you carry dirt. At that point, a thought begins to come into his mind. The unbelief in the community of what's happened is just catastrophic. The suffering that these people, this is a different bomb. There have been bombings where more people are killed in places like Dresden and so on, firebombing. But the sheer force of one bomb, which had taken this power that he'd actually given his life to try and harness for good, that what happened in that moment was almost like the power of God, where he took Adam and he created him out of dust. It's almost at that point, Robert Oppenheimer's creation, there's a video which I'm not going to show. Look it up on YouTube, where Oppenheimer quotes what had happened to him as he invented the atomic bomb when it first been dropped. He said initially there was this elation and then silence at this test site in White Sands, New Mexico. And at that point, Oppenheimer, raised in a Jewish home, quoted scripture. He didn't quote the Torah. He quoted the Bhagavad Gita, the Hindu scriptures, where Kali takes on his multi-armed form and says, "Lo, behold, I am become the destroyer of worlds, death." And at that point, it's almost like God's work is undone. The earth returns to a formless mass. Humans, gone from being living entities, are obliterated in a flash of an eye. And here is God's man for the hour, Takashi Nagai, unlikely hero. What Takashi Nagai does at this point is he hears that the Christians are gathering at the cathedral, trying to make sense of what's happened. The cathedral's on fire, so they gather nearby at a safe distance and they begin a service. Normally only the priest would be asked to preach, but they ask Takashi Nagai. Nagai gets up and gives a sermon which is so controversial that even today I look at it and struggle to understand and hold it and appreciate it, the immensity of what he's saying. He gets up. Some people attempt to shout him down with what he's saying. And he says, "Christians of Urakami, the bomber we've discovered from the radio was heading for a different city. Yet at the last minute, the weather changed, and seemingly a choice was made for the bomb to be dropped on us." Takashi Nagai says, "I believe that God has allowed 300 years of persecution. And that actually, if we're people who follow the cross of Jesus Christ, who gave up his life, who are called to walk to a crucifixion, God has allowed us to be crucified so that others may live." He says that basically God has allowed us to become tough. And that what you realize at this moment is the idea of what we've been talking about, of living out of faith. We live in a secular desert. Nagai lives in a place that's literally been made into a desert. But at that point, the cross is the only thing which makes sense. Nagai and a man have a confrontation near his home. This man comes to him hearing about the sermon and just rails at him. "Why has God allowed this? What is God doing? I hate you and I hate your God." Takashi Nagai listens and begins to share the gospel with him. This man breaks down and gives his life to Christ. A few days later, this man, who had become one of many disciples of Takashi Nagai, his hands and his legs as his body fails. Him and this man go, "We've got to do something. We've got to have some symbol that in the midst of this culture of death, that God is alive, that love is undefeatable by an atomic bomb." They find near the cathedral the bell that had been created when the church was built, that meant so much to these people who had to walk over this image of Christ. And they are hoisted on this just temporary structure, and they begin to ring it. It's twilight. Devastated landscape. The only lights are the lights of people sitting around campfires trying to understand how the world just ended for them. And this bell, ding, ding, begins to ring out. And what the guy's doing at that point is exactly what Andrew was saying at the moment when he's reciting the psalm as he held his friend. But that wasn't just some nice little thing to do, that literally what he's doing, someone who's given his life to the cross, who's literally living it now, because that is all the only option these people have, is that he is redeeming and participating in God's action in the world, even when every hope is lost. And what we're called to do, to go from here, is to be people who, in a sense, ring that bell. In a secular landscape where people have forgotten that moment when everything seems lost, to erect in somehow the ruins of church in a post-Christian society, to erect that bell and to ring it and to evoke in the back of the mind those Christian memories which have made this country, those forgotten memories. I said on the first night, we don't know Australian Christian history, but it's there. The story of revivals amongst Aboriginal communities, the stories of the Salvation Army going into the trenches in World War I, the stories of preachers going out on horseback into the outback in remote communities. The stories are there. We've simply forgotten them. And what we're called to do is to ring those bells of remembrance. Takashi Nagai begins to lose the power in his body. He sits now a single father in a bed, but something incredible begins to happen. Here's this man who lives in a city that's utterly destroyed. This man has no positional power anymore. His hospital's destroyed. His physical power is gone. He's literally an invalid. But a steady stream of people begin to come to his bed. And he talks to them about God. And here in this ultimately unchristian culture, people begin to come and listen to the word of God. Finally, the unthinkable happens. Celebrities begin to come. One of the world's leading violinists, the Pope sends an emissary. People come from the United States. Helen Keller, the famous woman who's blind and deaf, comes to meet him. They have to hear about this man who somehow is exemplifying God's love in the worst situation. And then the most insane thing happens. The man that Japanese culture followed into the war, the man who literally Japanese people at this time believe is a demigod, who's descended from the gods, the emperor, who literally thousands of soldiers had given their lives to, committed suicide, flown planes, kamikaze, into destroyers in service of this man. This man who lives in a palace in the center of Tokyo gets on the train. Comes out. And sits and listens to Takashi Nagai. This is ultimately authority versus power. This is the laying down of power. This man had nothing left, yet in that moment the gospel is presented in the most pristine fashion because he has nothing. Finally, the time came for him to die and he was surrounded by his friends. At the last moment, his son handed to him the cross which had been on the wall, the cross before which him and Midori had prayed, the cross which had seemingly, he thought, was destroyed in the bomb but had remained in the ruins. And his last view of this world is holding onto that cross as he passed into God's coming kingdom. He's buried next to Midori, and on the grave is written this from Luke's gospel. We are unworthy servants. We have only our duty. What a contrast to the language that we use today. You're awesome. This generation is going to do mighty things and all that. Now, I'm not saying I don't believe that stuff. But so many of those other statements are made, built upon the layers of these selves that I've talked about. What a different world it would be. What a different country it would be. What a different church it would be in Australia if this is actually a model of self. And what you realize is what he's modeling here is a kind of martyrdom. and that the Christian gospel has actually always been about martyrdom. That the women who went across the seas, never to get married, to go to preach the gospel in Africa, not on a short-term mission trip, but they're coming back after 3 years or going for a month and then stopping in Singapore for shopping. For these women who literally just went off, never to be seen again. Think of people like William Carey, people who lost children, people who didn't actually give their lives, but saw their life giving to the poor, moving into poor communities, giving their lives to throw themselves into something, secular occupations, religious occupations, whatever, with a completely different mindset, the mindset of martyrdom. William Kavanagh says this, the Christian writer, "Martyrdom is a bridge between heaven and earth, not because the martyr is soon to travel, so it's not meant to be rebel, not to travel one way to her eternal reward, but because heaven has been brought to earth in the form of one who, in imitating Jesus the Christ, has cheated earthly death of its sting. A martyr is one who lives imaginatively as death does not exist." Takashi Nagai brought heaven to earth because he lived the gospel as if death didn't matter. He brought, in a sense, a partnership with God, heaven to earth. The answer to our secular culture that we live in, I believe now, is a new kind of martyrdom. And that's not to say, I'm not going to be prescriptive here, I'm not going to say what this means. It's going to be different things for different people. But it's a spirit. It's a spirit of giving up to try and live out the expansive, expressive self, the pagan self that we've been given by our culture. That actually, the gospel was always about the denial of self. The kingdom is given to those who seek after these things. Yes, Jesus in John 10:10 says, "I've come to have life in abundance." But that has to be held in tension with what Jesus says in Mark, that, you know, "I've called you to take up your cross and follow me to your death." You have some churches just want the death thing. You've got some churches that just want the life thing. It's a creative tension between the two, and we major in the life thing. At the end of, or the period that historians unfairly call the Dark Ages, when Europe had been Christianized but then returned to its pagan roots, the gospel was retreated. Often we look at the time that the whole of Europe was Christian and now it's not. It's more like a bust and boom cycle. There was one small group of people in Ireland, the Celtic Christians. And they completely re-Christianized Europe, people who'd forgotten. And what they did was that they got in these little boats and they put themselves out to sea. They went on a road, on a journey, on a pilgrimage. But it was not like the road that we've been talking about this weekend. It was a road of martyrdom and of self-denial. And what I want to do is I want to end with a question. In a second, we're going to watch a video to end. But all I want to do is ask the question, what if? What if we took this stuff seriously? What if we lived this new martyrdom? We've made a video and we thought we're not going to end like a typical thing. What is a typical thing these days? Not sure. But this video is put to pictures. It's a manifesto that when we started Uber, we wrote. And we actually didn't know what we were going to do with it. We wrote it down on paper 5 years ago, and it stayed in a drawer. And I think actually what this was, in some sense, is a prophetic challenge. The time wasn't right. But in somehow this weekend, all of the work that's happened over years, that what God's been doing has come to this moment where now it's time to present this, and it's a challenge. And what I'd like to do is we're going to play the video. It's loud. It's got different words which are going to, we're going to challenge you. And at the end of it, I'm not going to say anything. How I want to end is, I don't want to do an emotional altar call. I don't want to do anything like that. We're just going to have some silence. At the end of the silence, I'll pray. But what I want you to do is, if you want to respond to this, because you know what? There's been stacks of words this weekend. Christian culture at the moment is filled with words. What I would like to do is to offer you a chance to actually incarnate. We're not going to pray out loud. This is going to be actually a lived prayer, an enacted physical example of what you want to do. All I'm going to ask you to do is to pray by standing. If you want to sign up for this, it doesn't mean anything. You're not signing up to any movement. There's no emails coming. But If this challenge resonates with you, if you want to stand and do something different in this country because 2% is not acceptable, I ask you to do so at the end of this thing. It's going to be probably awkward. It's going to be silent. But do it as a lived prayer.